Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show. Show. Before we begin, let's hear a quick message from our sponsor.
Hello, HR. It's me, your HR data. And I need to apologize. I'm sorry for being all over the place. I'm sorry for being difficult. I'm sorry for not being there for you. But it's not my fault. You put me in different HR systems and messy spreadsheets. But guess what? I now have a new friend, and their name is Employee Cycle. They can put all of me in one HR dashboard for you and keep me updated and simple so we'll better understand each other. Look, we're smarter when we're working together, so if you want me to show you my full potential, please go to employeecycle.com to get your free demo today. That's employeecycle.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce Marable, CEO of the all-in-one HR analytics dashboard. But enough about that. I am so excited about our guest today to help us figure out, can HR fix a toxic workplace? There are so many things going on in the world in regards to companies and how they're really messing up, and especially in Philly right now, where we had a huge workplace mix-up at a local Starbucks. But we don't have to get into that right now because our guests can talk all about it. So would you please help me give a warm round of applause and introduction to Laurie Rudiman, HR consultant. Woo!
Hey, guys. Hi. How's it going?
Thank you. Thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. I truly, truly appreciate it.
Well, I'm really happy to be here, and I'm happy to connect with your audience. You know, my name is Laurie Rudiman, and nobody can spell it. So if they're looking to connect with me on the internet, they can just Google, like, I hate human resources or, you know, HR sucks, and they will find me. So Rudiman is tough, but I hate HR is easy.
I know that I introduced you as an HR consultant, but you do so much more than that. So as our tradition, would you please answer our initial question, which is, how did you end up in the wonderful world of HR?
Oh my goodness. Well, this could be a therapy session if we let it go like that. So we won't. We'll stay high level. I went to college and thought I was going to be a lawyer. And then I discovered what lawyers do for a living. And I didn't want to do that. And I wasn't quite sure what I could do with an undergraduate degree in English. And so I took an internship in human resources in 1995, and I didn't look back. I held a job in HR from 95 to 2007, and I worked for some companies you know, like Pfizer and Monsanto, and some that you don't, and had progressively more complex roles and ended up really hating what I was doing for a living. I didn't really do it very well. But I love the world of work and I love the world of HR. So in 2007, I went out on my own and started writing and speaking about HR and technology and social media and had a consultancy. And voila, a decade later, I'm still doing it. So it is possible to take what you're good at and pivot, even if you don't like it. There's always another career path for you. And I'm a living example of that.
That was great. Awesome. So our topic is, can HR fix a toxic workplace? And I know a lot of people are really interested in this. So let's start with the definition of a toxic workplace. What does that mean to you? What does that look like?
Well, I think there are probably two to three components of a toxic work environment. It's a place where when you spend any time in that environment, it makes you feel bad about yourself. So let's start right there. So that could apply to work environments, it could apply to interpersonal relationships, or it could apply to your home life. But I think if you don't feel good about yourself right there, that environment is toxic. I also think a toxic work environment is a place where you go and you don't find yourself being the best version of yourself. So if you show up at work and you're mean, you're cruel, you're not compassionate, you don't demonstrate empathy, that's a toxic work environment, and the sooner you can see it, the sooner you can get the heck out of there.
So for the HR leaders listening out there, sometimes you're so deep in the weeds of what you're doing that you really don't even know what's happening. Or there's so many times where you could have blind spots in different departments and different areas of your company where you might not become aware of it until it's too late. So let's start there, the beginning of how do you even identify whether your workplace is toxic or not?
Yeah. Well, I think blind spots are a leftover privilege from the 20th century. So if you have a blind spot and you're not paying attention and you're surprised when your work environment is reported on or somebody says it's toxic, that's on you as an HR leader. If you are in the world of HR in 2018, you no longer have the luxury of keeping your head down and saying, I'm too busy to be out of touch with the climate of my organization. Your job is dependent on making sure that your organization isn't reinforcing institutional racism or sexism. Your job is responsible for guaranteeing the safety of each individual and making sure that pay is fair and equitable. And if you're not doing those basic things, you should not be in the role of human resources. So I know HR professionals are busy, Bruce, because I used to be one, and I'm busy today, even as a consultant. But busy is a choice. And what we pay attention to is a choice. And I think the function of HR has to make better choices about what we're paying attention to. You know, it's great that you're sitting in executive meetings, but look up, look at who's in that meeting. And if everybody looks the same, it's time to act. So start there. Pay attention and don't fall back on the excuse of being busy. Bruce, I have no tolerance for that.
This is going to be a raid. Candid conversation.
I love people it. Are either going to love me or hate me. That's usually how it is. The words people use to describe me are caustic and cynical, but I'm not. Like, I'm a sweetheart of a lady. I'm 5 feet tall. I'm really nice, right? You know, but I just don't have a lot of tolerance for mediocrity. And there are all these HR professionals out there, and I know they're my friends who are like, yeah, we're changing the world. And it's like, are you? Because people are getting arrested at Starbucks and women are getting paid 76 cents on the dollar. We got a lot of work to do. And I know we're there for the business, but you don't have a good business if you're not taking care of your people. And I think that message has been lost over the past 25 years. And I'm here to fix it. Like, that's my job. My job is no longer to help companies do better performance management. My job is to help companies treat their workers better. And that starts with being compassionate, empathetic, and just making sure that their basic civil rights are paid attention to.
So I know you said that, you know, in the 20th century, it's no longer acceptable for you to have your head buried in the sand and not pay attention. We're past that. But clearly, we're not past that. So for all of the HR leaders out there who believe or at least thought that they were paying attention, but they really weren't, how do you help them wake up?
Yeah,
and say, you know what? You know what? I thought I was paying attention, but I really had no idea what the hell was going on.
Because
the way that you were saying it is if it's so logical, which it is, but it's so logical and it's just the default. Like, oh yeah, of course I'm paying attention. But clearly people aren't.
No, they're not. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. So it takes individuals like me and individuals like you to hold our fellow professionals in HR accountable. But you're right. It's not logical and it's not simple and it's not easy, but the days of it being acceptable are over. And so I'll give you some examples. You know, we've got this conversation happening around Starbucks, right? Individuals go into Starbucks just like me, just like anybody else. They're hanging out in there. I go into Starbucks all the time to use the bathroom and steal their Wi-Fi. Nobody is arresting me, right?
Right.
I am a 5 foot tall white woman. In fact, they like me hanging out there. But for some reason on that day, it was unacceptable to be African American men in Starbucks. While it was sort of okay to have this bias and have this attitude yesterday, it's no longer okay to think like that today. So for me, it's not enough for Starbucks to apologize and close their stores and hold, you know, implicit bias training. I want them to be more candid about their training. I want the HR leaders at Starbucks to exactly tell us what they're going to teach their associates. I want to know as a customer, as a shareholder, as a consumer, not just because I want to hold Starbucks accountable, but I want to be a better individual. And this is where I think HR has a real opportunity to make a difference beyond just an employee base. If you're holding that training for your coworkers, share the good stuff and train everybody. Like, put that stuff on your website. Have webinars. Do whatever you can do as Starbucks to make the world a better place. And you know what? I'll be your customer for a lifetime. But unfortunately, they have, you know, an awkward apology, right? They're going to close their stores. And we don't know who's delivering that training. We have no idea. And we don't know what that training is. And I think if there's anybody out there listening who wants to tweet about this, go ask Starbucks to show us the good stuff. Show what they're training. And that's how HR makes a difference. But you're right. It's not like HR professionals are waking up in 2018 and going, you know what, I'm going to be accountable today. No, it takes right. people like you and me and individuals who go to Disrupt HR and individuals who read cool articles on the internet to say, great, we have good ideas. Let's start holding one another accountable.
To get back into the training, one of the things that I think about, and I was actually having a conversation with somebody with the other day, specifically with Starbucks, is I get that they're going to do the unconscious bias training, but are they going to go into the historical context of why this is the case in the first place? Because it doesn't seem like a lot of people really understand where the bias even came from in the first place. So I'm curious to know if you think that people should really get history lessons on this is how people were treated over time. And a part of me is thinking, well, again, it's very logical. You know how people were treated over time, but it doesn't seem like people do. And at this point in 2018, I don't know about everybody else, but I'm kind of throwing logic out the window just for anybody, for any reason. So I'm curious, do you think that training should be much more than just why you should not do what you're doing today, but this is how a certain group of people have been treated for a very long time, and this is how this is being impacted today, and this is why you shouldn't do certain things because this is how things have been, but you need to change this now so that the future can be different. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. So I'm going to tell you something. I don't think you can train people unless you love them and care about them. And I don't think they can learn unless they feel like it's a safe place and they're loved and cared for. So first of all, in order for any change to happen in this world, we need to come at it differently. We do need to do history lessons, but we also need to let individuals know, we know mistakes have been made. You've made a mistake. You know, you had a certain belief, you had a certain bias, but guess what? We're here to correct it. And it's not just going to be a punitive correction. The world is actually going to be better for it. And so I think about all of the history that we have with treating African Americans, Chinese, Native Americans, Latina women, poor white women haven't been treated all that great in America, right? Like, in even there are white men in Appalachia who are not treated well. I think if we approach this from a hermeneutic of trust and love and compassion and start to tell stories, not necessarily history lessons, although I'm not against that at all, because I think America is stupid, by the way, but also present day stories of what it's like to be a Latina woman earning 57 cents on the dollar, we're going to start to get somewhere when we can create an environment where people are having conversations. But that doesn't come from shutting down stores or bringing your employees into a conference room and lecturing them all day. There are really great thinkers and researchers out there who are talking about neuro-linguistic programming and storytelling and reframing stories. And if we can start to work with scientists and academia to teach people how to tell stories and to teach people how to listen, that's where the real training opportunity comes from. But I think you're absolutely right. Americans don't know their history and they don't know why things are the way they are today. So including history as part of the context of why you're sitting in this training is not a bad idea. So I support that 100%.
Great. And when it comes to creating this toxic environment, do you think it's people just being totally unaware of who they are and how they're impacting others? Do you think it's a lack of empathy? What do you think are the major characteristics of people who are creating this toxic environment?
I think there's one characteristic, and it's narcissism. So narcissism drives a toxic work environment. There are people in an organization who put their needs before the needs of others. And when you combine narcissism with institutional racism and institutional sexism, you've got a toxic work environment. So what drives narcissism in people? Well, I'm not a psychologist, but I do know that narcissists tend to be people who have been hurt, people who've been shamed, or people who haven't had appropriate boundaries set for them throughout their lifetimes. And if you think about leaders of organizations, oftentimes the way that they're promoted is through ruthlessness or nepotism or through systems and institutions that don't benefit anybody but a certain group of people. So we've created these systems that benefit narcissists, and we wonder why we're having racism still in 2018, or we wonder why we're having a Me Too moment in 2018. It's because we haven't done enough on both the personal accountability side, but we're not looking at like family of origin trauma. We're not looking at the reasons why systems exist. And so I think in the future, anthropologists are going to have a heck of a time looking back at us and just exploring all the ways that we've screwed up our lives. And hopefully those anthropologists will be human and not robotic, because the way we act these days, Bruce, we are putting our human civilization in jeopardy. We've got the scarcity idea, right? That the more I have, the better off I am. And if I have something, I need to get ahead of you. And I think the way the human race will survive and thrive is through a model of conscious capitalism and a model of just of generosity, where if I benefit, you benefit as well. I really believe a rising tide lifts all boats, but I'm one of a few, and you may think that, and you're one of a few who thinks that, but the people in power don't believe that. They believe that they're on the boat and they own the whole entire ocean. And so from my perspective, the way we're headed right now, I'm a little cynical about it, but you know, there are people out there who think humanity still has some potential. So I'd like to see that come through. We can start by doing some great training at Starbucks. How about that?
Nice.
Pull it all back together. Yeah.
Right. Right. I love it. I love it. Also love you calling out transparency around the training too. That's really important. And I hope we all do that. But when it comes to actually identifying how toxic your workplace is, if it's even toxic at all.
Yeah.
How does the HR person determine whether or not there's just one or two bad apples versus the whole company is going to shit? And how do they really gauge how bad the problem really is?
Well, I think sometimes when you're in that environment, it's very difficult to do that. Even if you're an objective human resources leader, it's tough to tell what's really going on. And so one of the things that's very important is to pull in some external whether it's experts or consultants to help you through that process. And you're like, oh my God, I don't have budget for that. But you don't not have budget to get somebody in who has expertise on human psychology and behaviors, because you as an HR business partner, you don't have it. And also you're a product of the environment that you're currently working in. So while you may think you're doing an objective investigation to figure out who are the troublemakers, you're not. The other thing is, if it ever goes to court, you're going to get subpoenaed and potentially have to testify as part of the ongoing machinations of the work environment. So if you're ever in a situation where stuff is going down and it's going down pretty hard, you got to pull in either an investigator or a consultant or a lawyer to help you navigate the world and get to the truth.
Got it.
So I guess what I'm really saying is HR can't truly assess a toxic work environment and can't get to the truth, because we are employees just like everybody else. And we have a POV that is biased and, you know, potentially infected by the reality around us. And so if you can, and you should, pull in some external experts, you know, an organizational effectiveness coach, somebody who has 20 or so years of experience in the HR consulting world and has done these kinds of investigations. That's my recommendation. Don't try to go it alone to get to the truth.
Now, we all know that HR typically has a hard time getting budget for anything, because that's just the way it is. And presumably probably won't change anytime soon. And although it's pretty logical, the reasons for why you should not want a toxic environment, I'm sure that our HR professionals out there and listeners, even of the show now, that are thinking, my workplace seems a little toxic right now. I've tried to get budget for this and it doesn't seem like I can. So what would you say to HR leaders listening to say, this is the reason, this is how you can actually paint the picture for why we need to stop this now, or at least investigate what's going on and how big of the problem do we have today before it really starts impacting the company, whether it's from a risk standpoint or a financial standpoint or any other way that's really going to push the stakeholders that need to make approvals to get them to really say, okay, you know what? Yes, you're right. Let's stop this before it becomes a huge problem.
Well, what we're talking about is influence and making a business case for change. And so that's your job in human resources, to really understand how to do that within your organization. And my advice is to start with data. And it's not really my advice. That's like everybody's advice. And especially my dear friend, Jennifer McClure. She has a whole keynote. And if you don't know Jennifer McClure, she's at jennifermcclure.net. She has a whole keynote and series of blog posts and articles and white sheets and one papers on upping your influence quotient. And she always recommends that you start with data and you challenge your own assumptions. So if there is a serious toxicity quotient in your environment, you want to get to the bottom of it, see if you can find that in the data of your organization, whether it's through survey work or through outcomes or through productivity or revenue or attendance or attrition, whatever it is, make the case for change through data. The second part is that don't go it alone. You need friends and allies at work to see this. So get an ally from the legal department and make the case for change based in an argument of compliance, or get an ally from finance and talk about risk. Whatever you can do to make this not an HR thing, but a business thing, you're going to be better off. So get some data and get some allies and work on personally improving your communication style, that you're effective enough that when you are presenting data and you are presenting business statistics and potential outcomes, you're persuasive, you're concise, and you're to the point.
Does it matter what size company I'm working at in regards to the approach that I'm going to take to try to fix this problem? So whether I'm at a 50-employee company or a 2,000-employee company, should I take the same steps to try to figure this out? Or are there different things and different people I should bring in based off my employee size and also industry?
I'm going to say a couple things. Number one, the smaller the company, the bigger the risk. If you let this go, you've got more to lose. You know, big companies can absorb financial risk all the time. They can reallocate budgets. And if someone makes a mistake, it's not going to bankrupt an organization. But the smaller the company, the bigger the risk. And so if someone is making allegations around sexual harassment or workplace harassment, and you ignore it, you are potentially jeopardizing the financial stability of your organization if you are a small company. So it's even more important if you're a company with fewer than 50 people. You know, legally, you've got to follow up on this. But again, if you do it on your own and you act like Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys or, you know, somebody who's a sleuth out there, you run the risk of doing it wrong. So the cost of getting a lawyer to help you figure out how do I create a really smart investigatory process is minimal compared to the amount of money you potentially could lose if you do it wrong. So I see it almost like inverse proportion. So if you're a small company, go buy an hour of a lawyer's time and get some really good advice.
And we've seen in the media, especially in media or entertainment businesses, where a lot of the people who are now getting caught up in sexual harassment or racism cases or around Me Too have been rainmakers. And they've been people who have brought the companies a lot of money or have been very successful at those companies. And it seems that some of the reasons why it takes a long time to out that person is because of their influence. So I'm going to take a guess and say that a lot of HR professionals might have even known about some of these things, but because of the influence and success of that individual, it's difficult for them to really gain a lot of support as to why those toxic individuals should not be there.
That's 100% accurate.
So, okay. So then, good. So if you agree with that, then how do the HR leaders listen now and say, wow, I deal with that today, or I see that bubbling up and I want to stop that before it happens? How do you be proactive and potentially stop that before it happens? And if you're living in that situation today, how do you still make sure that the company, regardless of the financial impact, gets rid of that person or handles it the right way before you actually have a larger negative impact when it comes out to the public or people are protesting or anything else that can happen?
Yeah, that's a $1 million question. And there's no easy answer because these are difficult problems of our time. I just did a session with my dear friend, Kate Bischoff, who works for Thrive Consulting. I think that's the name of her firm. And anyway, just Google Kate Bischoff. She's an employment lawyer and she's amazing. And we did a session for a bunch of art dealers and art historians and art gallery owners in New York City. So a ton of money, like old money, right? A ton of influence and a ton of weird boundaries in the Art Institute. And many people came up to us and asked, you know, there's this old art historian and he's been in the industry for years and he's known as a pervert. What do I do? And the question is, how brave are you and how much are you willing to turn a blind eye to this? And so I think now we have the Me Too movement coalescing. We've got a different language around race and gender and LGBT rights in our organizations. So I wouldn't necessarily take the default assumption that rainmakers and wealthy people can't go down. I would take another swing and try to, again, use data and to make a business case that this person has got to go. Or maybe don't even jump there, but make a business case that this has to be investigated. It has to be addressed. And you know, it's not just in the art world, it's not just in the sales world or in Hollywood, but there are even local, powerful theater companies who have been there for years. You have 50 years in the community, and the creative director of the theater guild has been there for 20 years, and it turns out he's a total pervert. And guess what? Those guys are starting to get fired. I read about it in local newspapers every day because brave individuals are saying, you know what? We're going to look at this with fresh eyes and we're going to try to be brave and we're going to try to be bold and we're going to be courageous and we're going to have a data-based conversation about the effects of employing this person any longer. So I would say it's tough. It's not easy. But again, that's why you work in human resources. You want an easy job? Go work at Baskin Robbins. I don't know what to tell you.
Got it. And a lot of
working with people is hard. That's why you do what you do, individuals. You love it. You love it. So do it right.
There we go. I hope people are taking notes and really internalizing what you're saying.
Taking notes. Absolutely.
You are preaching. I love it.
I love human resources so much. And I love my friends and colleagues in HR so much. And I really believe that HR sits at the intersection of work, power, politics, and money. I mean, yeah, technology. Yeah, human psychology and behavior. But work, power, politics, and money are so interesting. And we've blown it for so long. And I just feel like we're at an inflection point. We could really change the world in human resources if we stop letting people steal our agenda and do human resources for us. So I think it's our time. I really believe in people.
I actually want to come back to that, which you just said, people stealing HR's agenda. But one more question about people being toxic inside the office, but then outside the office as well. How should HR deal with that when people are coming to the office and saying, I was at a happy hour, which wasn't necessarily hosted by the company, but I was there with other people who I work with and they acted inappropriately. I know this may be more of a legal question, but in your opinion, is that something that HR should be dealing with? Because it seems like a lot of these situations are not necessarily happening in the physical office or in the four walls of the company, but they're happening on business trips and they're happening at happy hours and they're happening when people are just walking to go grab coffee. So how do you think HR should deal with those issues? And I know that's a pretty sticky problem.
Well, it's also a big question because it could be that it's a happy hour that mostly has work people and a few contingent, you know, employees who are part of the gig economy but aren't on your payroll. And then there's vendor, right? You know, the vendor's hosting it. And it really depends on the situation. But HR can do a couple of things. They can make sure that they have non-discrimination and non-bullying policies, right? They can have the right policies in place that are clear about behaviors and how people should interact with one another. And also make sure that there are policies that clearly direct behaviors when you're talking about vendors and you're talking about people who are contract employees of your organization. So the more you have a thoughtful policy handbook, and then the better off your training is, the better off you're going to be. The other thing you can do is start to talk about this with your employees before they even go to that happy hour and before they even go to that business trip. Like, have a town hall and start to do role playing and say, what do you think would happen if X, Y, and Z happened? How would you act? And you can start to create rules and norms of behaviors so that at least everybody is aware that these are potential situations. Because here's the deal, Bruce. What I think happens is that people go to happy hour and they get surprised. And then it makes it worse, right? They're almost do a pre-mortem on this, which is envision the worst thing that could possibly happen before it happens, and then work backwards to solve the problem before it happens. So if you have a conversation with your workers and say, listen, you might go to a happy hour and a vendor may hit on you, and that's not acceptable. And here's some language that you can use. When that happens, they're going to be equipped with the tools that they have and they need to get out of that situation quickly. So that's what I would recommend.
Got it. And then a couple of seconds ago, you said HR needs to stop letting other people take their agenda and do the HR for them. Can you explain? Yes. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, right now we're going through a transformation in human resources where a lot of the work that we used to do is automated and it's becoming part of business processes like payroll, like onboarding, like applicant tracking systems, right? And so the business has greater insight into what's happening in human resources. Unfortunately, they also think that makes them competent in HR. And we have to stand our ground and remind individuals, you work in finance. You work in accounting, you work in procurement, you have a level of expertise, you're educated and you're certified. Guess what? The same is true for me in human resources. I know what I'm doing. I'm an expert in human behavior. I'm an expert in the law and compliance and risk. We can work collaboratively, but this domain expertise is mine. And so I think one of the ways that we can show our expertise and really gain favor with our colleagues is by having better relationships. Oftentimes, we want to build a wall around HR and say, no, this is mine and don't touch it. And again, I think that's important. Procurement should not be touching employment law, although they do all the time. But instead, we say, you know what? We hear your ideas and let's talk about it. And you know what? I want to talk about procurement too. I'm going to show an interest in your area of the business as well. But again, I think finance, legal, accounting, all of these departments are getting it a little wrong. And they think, well, because something is technology and now doesn't mean it's HR. Guess what? It's still HR. So that's how I feel.
So now I want to ask you about people being comfortable enough to come to HR and actually talking about the issues that are happening in the workplace. Because there is this perception of HR where HR isn't really there for me as the employee, but they're actually there for the company. So how does HR proactively make employees feel super comfortable that the HR person is really going to stand up for them versus only looking at the best interests of the company?
So I would say that it's not an either or and it's not a both. Why can't it be situational? Or why can't it be that standing up for employees is good for the business and having the back of the business is good for employees? Why can't it be all of that, right? So what I think, though, for so long has happened is that employees have gone to HR and then HR has either ignored them or ratted them out, or not given them a sufficient resolution for their issues.
Yep.
So going forward, I think HR professionals have to get educated and really think critically about what it means to work in human resources. And for me, if I was an HR business partner or a director today, I would view my life situationally. And I would ask the question every time I'm faced with a tough situation, what is the right thing to do by the business? What is the right thing to do by the employee? And where is the shared interest? And I think in that Venn diagram is the good stuff, right? In that Venn diagram, in the center of it, when you're advocating on behalf of both the employee and the business, that's where you're in your best level of work. And so how do you communicate that to the workforce? Well, maybe you start by apologizing. I don't know. That's a radical idea. Maybe you start by being honest about where you failed in the past. Or maybe you start to build better relationships with individual workers so that when something happens, you don't have a reputation for selling people out. You know, you've got people in the organization, line workers in the trenches who really believe in you as an HR professional and know you as a good human being. So I think the solution to a lot of this is relationships.
Okay. And people are crazy. We all do crazy things. Yeah, I just had to start off. I just had to start off this question. People are crazy.
They are. Yeah,
we're
true.
Unpredictable. We do a lot of crazy shit for so many different reasons. And when you get past, I want to say, 5 employees, it might even be 2. Once you have 2, you have no idea what the other person is going to do. But once you get to a certain size, you really run the risk of so many different types of people coming together, not really knowing how they're going to interact, and who knows what they're going to be doing. So my question to you is, regardless of the company size, regardless of what goes on, because all the entire workforce is under HR's watch, is it always HR's fault if a community becomes toxic? It's something I was thinking about, especially after the Starbucks thing happened.
Yeah.
Because you think on one hand, oh, this is pretty terrible and it should never happen. So I get why they shut down all the locations. But on the other hand, is there any way that the EVP or VP of HR or whatever the title is, the most senior HR people leader at Starbucks, they had no idea that this could have happened at this one particular location out of, I think I looked at last night, it was 14,000 Starbucks locations. So is it the HR person's fault that that particular instance happened?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. So I'm not sure who the EVP of HR at stores at Starbucks is right now, but it used to be my good friend, Scott Petoskey.
You know everyone.
I do, yeah. So I don't know who it is right now, but Scott Petoskey used to have that job. And Scott Petoskey is one of the best human beings I have ever met in my whole entire life, right? So to say it's the individual fault of HR or the individual fault of a practitioner, I think maybe not is not even the point. The point is that for whatever reason, this stupid way of behaving at Starbucks stores, and maybe not at every Starbucks store, but that Starbucks store happened, right? That happened. And I think collectively, it's an opportunity for all Starbucks stores to elevate their game and to get into the 21st century and start behaving in empathetic, compassionate ways. Not logically, just behaving like decent human beings who give a fuck about other human beings. Can I say that? Do you need to blur that out?
Nope,
I'm sorry.
Nope. Keep going.
All right. So I'm not someone who likes to blame human resources, but here's the deal. Once you know, you are absolutely accountable, not just legally, but morally. If you know something is wrong in your workforce and you don't do your darndest to fix it, it's on you. And that's where I start to get mad at human resources departments, because I have worked in enough HR departments where we have said, you know what, that guy's a dick. But again, he's a rainmaker, or that guy's a dick, but you know what? His dad got him that job. And we let it go. We let it go because we're scared. And that's what makes us complicit. So again, if you're in that job in human resources, I'm not looking to blame you. But if you know and you don't do anything, you're part of the problem.
So I have a question for you. And this is, sorry, audience, if this is not relevant to most of you, but most people who work in HR are women. And one of the things that I always think about is what happens to the HR person, or how does the HR person handle a situation when it's happening to them?
Oh, and I've had that happen.
I don't know if I've ever seen a story or read an article about that. So I'm so curious, who does HR go to?
So I have both, I have my own Me Too stories, and I've also been HR for HR professionals. So a couple things. Number one, when you're in human resources or when you're a woman or a person of color, especially women and people of color and people of the LGBT community, you're often told that you don't have worth, right? So it's really hard when you're in HR and you're a woman and HR is always being denigrated and you're a woman and you're told, well, you're not a strategic thinker. It's really hard to be your own advocate. So I never look at victims and say, why didn't you speak out more? Why didn't you quit? Why didn't, you know, like, it's just, it's complicated. When people don't feel like they have any value, they can't be their own advocates. And so if they're in the world of human resources, like I was, I had a boss who, like, I was 24 years old and he was the VP of HR, and he liked to tell me about how bad his marriage was. Mm. And I thought, well, he's my boss. He's trying to be my friend. That's cool. And then eventually he started asking me, what'd you do this weekend? And then he eventually started telling me about what he did and didn't do with his wife that weekend. And it was pretty gross and pretty disgusting. But, you know, I felt like, well, he's my boss. I have to listen to him. He's trying to be my friend. And I can't be sexually harassed. I work in human resources, right? We're buddies. We're having conversations. And on top of that, I was being given raises from this guy.
Huh.
And eventually, my mom got sick, and one day I came to work and this guy asked me, did you get any this weekend? And I'm like,
whoa.
Excuse me, my mom is in the hospital. Yeah.
Whoa.
And it was at that moment that I had a wake-up call. He didn't give a shit about me. All he wanted to do was use me to talk about his own weird marriage stuff. But I didn't have anywhere to go. And so I went to the CEO of the company and I said, I'm having these experiences. And they brought in an outside investigator and they basically gave this guy a slap on the wrist. But because we had had this situation happen between us, I could no longer report into him. They had me report into another director of HR. So it was a demotion. And so I ended up quitting my job. And after that moment, it has been my life's journey to tell HR professionals, you're of worth, your job is important. You know, if you see something, say something. And also, you are an employee. You have rights. You have a right to go to work in a safe and like productive and supportive environment. And you are not an object for someone else's story. But I think so often in HR, we forget that we are our own. We're employees, right? And we are subject to all the weird things that happen in other departments. And so if that's happening to you in human resources, I'm very sorry, but you need to speak up. And if you can't speak up, I'm so very sorry for that. Come talk to me, go talk to a friend, go talk to somebody, and let's brainstorm a way to get you into a better job that treats you like the amazing human capital professional that you are.
I know when I first asked you, how did you end up in HR, that was the first question of the episode. And you said, I don't want to make this a therapy session, but
we just went there.
But I'm curious to know, when I think about the HR role, it's not that different of a therapist where they're constantly, or you are constantly listening to other people's problems. And anyone who's in a role like that, regardless of how strong you are or disconnected. And when I say disconnected, I mean like not emotionally invested in them because you're not family or you're not their friend. It still has to weigh you down. So I'm curious, as you're navigating throughout all this toxic nonsense and all of this craziness that's happening in the workplace, how should you focus on self-care so that you can actually handle all this with the right mind and the right attitude?
You know, my friend Sarah Morgan, she writes The Buzz on HR. She speaks so eloquently on this. She does not apologize for self-care. So I think that's the first perspective. Like, you know, back in the 80s and the 90s, you know, my mom, her mom, all of our moms, if they went to work, and my mom did, my mom is a retired Chicago police officer. She missed out on a lot because she had to work. You know, she had to provide for the family. And I think we're at a different point in our lives, whether it's women or men, that we no longer need to apologize for taking time for ourselves. So if you need to leave work early, you don't owe anybody an explanation because your CEO has work-life balance, your CFO has work-life balance. You need to take care of yourself. So do it unapologetically. I think the second thing, again, I keep going back to relationships, but you've got to have a squad. You've got to have people that know what you do for a living and understand how difficult it is. Because Bruce, you are right. HR can see the underbelly of an organization and it will eat your soul alive if you let it. So you have to find friends, people who understand your work, and you just have to share, but not only share, you don't want to dump on people, right? That's no fun. You don't want to be that friend. You want to listen. And then I think HR is like therapy, but I also think at its best, it can be like a coach. So when you get your squad assembled, make sure you're coaching one another. Like, hear the complaints, let people rant, but make sure you focus on problem solving and putting it in perspective.
I love that. And I love the advice that you gave about creating a squad. Myself, I call it a tribe, but it's the exact same thing. And I have a tribe of other startup founders who can only understand what you're going through. as you're building software and building a company and hiring people and working with co-founders, you're in this silo, in this vacuum, this bubble of yours every day. So to have other people to be able to totally understand what you're going through is invaluable. So really love that advice.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's saved my life more times than not, let me tell you.
So the last question of this section I want to ask for our listeners is what general advice do you have to our listeners in regards to stopping your company becoming toxic, dealing with a toxic work environment, or just being able to get the budget or have the influence to be able to do something about it?
Yeah, I think so often HR professionals don't know. And so, again, we don't have the luxury of not knowing anymore. You have to ask. So if you can become an HR department that's focused on the employee experience and the employee journey and make an employee-centric focused nature out of your HR department, you're going to know, and you're going to know pretty quickly. So that means looking at everything from onboarding to training and development to conflict resolution from an employee perspective. That means interviewing a lot of employees and asking them about their experiences. And I think that active interviewing people and asking them, what is it like to go through onboarding? What is it like to go through it from your perspective as, you know, a gay African-American man or a trans woman or, you know, even just a middle-aged white guy? What is it like for you at our company? And starting to collect those stories, you're going to get in touch with your company and its climate pretty quickly.
Great. So now we're going to go into a lighter section because that was pretty deep. That was pretty heavy. We're going to go into my favorite part of the podcast, which I like to call the real, the random, and the ridiculous, where I ask you, Lari, a random and ridiculous question. Are you ready?
Yeah, sure. I am.
Okay, real question. Do you like bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
I do like bread pudding. My mother-in-law makes bread pudding for the holidays every Christmas day.
I'm coming over.
Yes, and she's amazing. My mother-in-law, Joyce, is just an angel. I've been so blessed with just an amazing role model, a woman in my life. But every year she makes a different recipe because there are thousands of bread pudding recipes out there, and she just likes to do something different. So some years it has pears in it. Some years, you know, peaches. Some years cranberries. Some years raisins. I'll eat whatever Joyce feeds me. I like bread pudding, so I love Joyce.
So glad, and you just made my heart smile. And you made me hungry too.
And I never get to talk about how much I love my mother-in-law, so this is great. Thank you for the opportunity.
So I know we're going to have at least one more listener of this episode because of that.
There you go.
I like to call myself a bread pudding connoisseur, so I always ask that question. Ooh. Because I like.
What do you like?
Oh, pecan bread pudding, ooh, vanilla, butterscotch.
Oh, yeah.
Some with raisins, some without, Irish cream, all different types. I love it.
And whoa, Irish cream. I've never had that.
Irish
that
cream,
sounds great.
Chocolate sauce, sometimes with ice cream. It just all depends. There's a whole world of bread pudding out there.
It really is. I don't think people understand
no,
that.
No, they don't. And I love when I'm interviewing people all across the country because they give me spots of where to go once I visit their hometown to find the best bread pudding. So clearly the best bread pudding with you is your mother-in-law. So I will be there. All right. Random question, Lari. Do you have Spotify?
I do.
All right. Favorite song right now that you're just listening, that you're like, you know what? I'm about to run or I'm getting on a flight. Something that just puts you in a good mood.
Yeah, it's so funny that you mentioned that because the band was just in town last night and I was traveling and couldn't see them. But I am currently listening to the new album by The Decemberists, and they have a new song out called Severed. And so The Decemberists were big like in the early 2000s, and they were kind of this weird jangly folk indie band, and they were okay. But this new album is really different, and I hear tones of like David Bowie in it. And it's kind of good. I mean, it still kind of represents their genre quite well, but the song Severed is excellent. So The Decemberists, Severed, is my new running song right now.
Great. I'm going to check that out. And then to bring it full circle with a ridiculous question. What's the most ridiculous reason you've heard or seen for companies not to try to fix their toxic workplace?
Well, I mean, there's so many answers. One I think is that the most ridiculous thing is that companies are in denial. Like, they don't believe it. They're like, nah, this can't be true. You know, they've got a survey. They've got data. They've got all this information, both analytical information and anecdotal information telling them their company culture fucking sucks. And they're in denial. And I'm like, oh, there's no fixing you. There's no fixing crazy. And at that point, what do? You have to take care of yourself. And it's probably time to move on, right? So that's the most ridiculous thing I can think of. In denial.
Great answer. And then last question of the podcast, favorite and least favorite part of working in HR?
My favorite part was the parties. I always had fun at parties. I know that's ridiculous because HR, we're not supposed to be party planners. But my friend Tim Sackett says, if you can plan the party, you can make the party whatever you want. And he's 100% right. Like, my parties were always the best. I'm like, yeah, we're going to eat the food I want. We're going to listen to my music. We're going to go to the places I want to go, right? I made the party what I wanted to be. I love champagne. So, you know, we're going to have champagne. So, yeah. Party planning, which is probably the least strategic answer I can give, was my favorite part. The least favorite part for me, when I worked at Pfizer, I was in charge of doing mass layoffs. And I had to let my husband know that he was losing his job. And he didn't believe me. He did not. We worked together. And I'm like, honey, guess what? Guess what's going to happen tomorrow? You're going to get called into a meeting. And I know this, you know, and just get ready for it. And he's like, you don't work in my division. You don't know. Jesus. Okay, I don't know.
Do you know what HR does?
He clearly did not. And so he goes to work the next day and his whole division is laid off. I'm like, boo, I told you, you know, I'm sorry about that. But delivering that kind of bad news broke my heart. But I think the reason why I was put in that job is that I was designed to do it. Like, I'm little, I'm this sweet woman. I care about people. And if anybody is going to deliver really significant and potentially heartbreaking news, which is what I did when I worked at Pfizer for 3 years. I consistently went around the world and told people that we were shutting down sites and getting rid of their jobs. If anybody was going to do it, I think I was put on the earth to do it because I did it with compassion and empathy and sensitivity. So I didn't enjoy it and it really burned me out, but I did the best that I could. And I think the testament to that is I started up just recently a new podcast called Let's Fix Work. And I've heard from so many people that I used to work with at Pfizer who have been following my entrepreneurial journey for the past 11 years. They still love me. They still care about me. They still are invested in my outcome, even though I told them, guess what? Your job is going away. So I think I did okay. I hope I did right by them. Yeah, but it was hard.
I'm sure you did. You seem like a very caring person. I'm sure you did the right thing.
Caring, caustic, and cynical. I'm complicated.
Are we all? Are we all? And with that, I want to thank you so much for making this the most awesome, informative, educational, and entertaining podcast. So thank you, Lori! Woo!
Honor. And everybody, please feel free to connect with me in real life. Like, I'm a nice lady. And if I can be helpful to you, you're now part of my network. So thanks again, Bruce, for the opportunity.
No worries. So where can people find you and your company and all the amazing things you do online?
Yeah, they can find me if they can spell my name at lorirudiman.com. And they can also find me on their favorite podcast player or go to letsfixwork.com.
Perfect. And we'll put all of that in the show notes. Your name might not be the easiest to spell, so we'll definitely have that spelled correctly in the show notes as well.
Thank you. Thank you again.
No worries. So, HR listeners out there, I'm sure you love this episode. If so, please make sure you leave us a 5-star iTunes rating. And if you have any notes about how we can make this better, or if you just don't like me, well, that's fine too. I'll read that as well. Also, if you aren't subscribed to this podcast, please make sure we are on your favorite podcast player. And again, HR listeners out there, please continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Thanks. Later, kids.